Accession number 28361, reel 54.
General Julian Thompson, reel 54. You were saying that you had all these prisoners of war. Presumably they were unanticipated, especially at such an early stage.
Yes.
in the campaign.
They were, and as I said before, the facilities which had been brought out for them, like tents and other things, had gone to the bottom of the sea in the Atlantic and Bear, so we had nowhere to accommodate them. And moving them around was a problem. Eventually we got them back to Ajax Bay, where the logistic regiment was, and they put up a cage, but they had to live outside. There was no cover for them. They quite reasonably complained about this. But they were then put on board ships. By then it wasn't my problem, because divisional headquarters arrived, and I think what they did was they put them on board empty merchant ships in San Carlos, under guard, of course, and that's where they stayed until eventually they were shipped back to Argentina when the war was over. But by then it wasn't my problem.
Who actually did the processing of them, the searching and sorting out and so on?
That was originally done by my brigade intelligence organisation. The problem there was that with such a huge influx of prisoners, there weren't enough interpreters, let alone interrogators, because it's all very well, as you would appreciate, having an interrogator, but if he can't speak Spanish, he needs an interpreter as well. And there were very few of those. For example, one of the interpreters we had was a chap who was a Marine in my headquarters. I think he was a driver who'd been brought up in Gibraltar. In fact, he was a Gibraltarian, so he spoke Spanish, I suppose they would say of a kind, but I think it was quite good. And we found that they wouldn't take any notice of him, so he was quickly dressed up as a captain in order that he would have some sort of authority over them. But it was a problem, and it's one that's not exercised enough on peacetime exercises. And of course, you've got a moral duty to look after them and feed them and make certain that they don't come to harm and they don't die of cold. And I think it's quite interesting historically, looking back, quite often there have been cases, I don't mean with the Japanese, but with other people, where, for example, in the American Civil War, there have been cases where prisoners have died and got diseased and starved, and that is because not people have been trying to be nasty to them, but because they simply haven't got the means to look after them properly. And it's a lesson for the future. You've got to look after these people.
How did you solve the problems of providing them with food and so forth?
Because
you were short of rations, weren't you?
We weren't short of them. It was a question of getting rations forward to the forward troops. Yes. Of course, it being in the log regiment area, there was no problem overfeeding them, because that's where the rations came. So there was no problem about them.
What about medical attention?
Well, again, they couldn't have been in a better place for medical attention, because they were right alongside my dressing station. So there were plenty of doctors and medical staff to look after them there. They were literally sort of, you know, a few yards away. So again, that wasn't a problem. And our medics carried out a lot of operations on the Argentines and found that their standard of medical care had been quite low on the whole. And there were one or two people who were in a pretty bad way because of bad treatment by their medics. Or poor treatment, inadequate
poor treatment. Do you know what kind of conditions they were suffering from in particular?
Well, for example, my doctor told me that one chap he found, or two or three, they'd made the error, which is easy to make if you've not come across battle wounds before. If you see a wound, you sew it up. Well, that's the last thing you want to do. You want to open it out. Mm. And as Napoleon's surgeon, Baron Larry, said, you open it out and débridement, take out all the bits and open it to the air. But these guys just sewed them up, and so people got gangrene as a result.
Best to let the maggots do their work.
Exactly. So it was this sort of not bad treatment, but inexpert medical treatment that you would expect to get from a country that's never actually had a war in its history, and therefore its doctors have never had to deal with battle casualties and have no history of doing so.
How did they behave? Were they generally cooperative and amenable?
They were cooperative and amenable, on the whole. Their officers asked to keep their sidearms because they were frightened the men might turn on them.
Was there any hint of that, do you think?
No, well, they weren't allowed to keep their sidearms.
And they weren't lynched by their men?
No.
Were the officers separated from the soldiers?
Yes. Yes, they were, eventually. And one of the problems when you had that great mass was sorting them out.
Quite, yes.
Who's who and, you know, rank badges and people who perhaps hadn't got a rank badge and claimed to be something, and you had to decide whether their claim to be a major was actually true. Yeah. And you know, this sort of grey area you get in some armies of people who are neither other ranks nor officers. They're sort of in a sort of warrant officer class in an area that we don't have.
Who was in overall charge of handling them and looking after them?
Well, in the end, to begin with, the OC of the CEO of the log regiment was in place in overall charge, but in the end, the senior chap who came out with the battle casualty replacements was put in charge of them. Then after that, I don't know, because it then became a divisional responsibility, and I think the Colonel AQ, as we would have called him then, in the division, took over responsibility, and I think a chap was shipped out from England actually to take charge, a colonel, an RCT colonel was sent out to organise the prisoner handling and the prisoner set up.
When you separated the officers, did you have a separate compound for them? Sort of
as far as I know, I mean, I didn't actually go and see them. By the time they had come to Ajax Bay, which is where the prisoners were being held, I had moved my headquarters forward out of San Carlos and thankfully dumped the problem onto my divisional commander.
What about intelligence? Did you get any really useful intelligence from them?
Quite a lot, and certainly if you have time you should talk to a chap called Nick Vanderbilt, who was my WO1 in the INT Corps, who ran the interrogation setup, who was a trained interrogator. And I'll give you his details. And he'll be able to tell you just how much intelligence was garnered. And there was quite a lot. Of course, what you've got to remember is from the Goose Green prisoners, they could only tell you about Goose Green, effectively, which which wasn't a problem anymore. It was ours.
Right.
And the chaps from outside Goose Green, i.e. the two reinforcing companies, didn't really know anything about what was going on, other than the fact they'd been told to move one day from A and gone straight into the bag at B. So not much, really.
Background, then, rather than tactical.
Well, you could get background stuff, but I don't remember there being a great deal of it.
Presumably that wasn't really what you wanted. You didn't want contact.
I wanted contact really. Intelligence, and so really I wasn't getting that. And we got that later, much more of it later.
What impact did the arrival at divisional headquarters have on you overall?
Well, it was a great boon. It relieved me of what I regarded as a chore, which was dealing with the task force headquarters, which was a headquarters that I found not particularly simpatico. I could get on with commanding my brigade and thinking about that, and I didn't have the burden of bothering about what the Navy were up to. I could forget the joint bit. I'm not suggesting one minute that I didn't find that rewarding, but it became increasingly a distraction from getting on with the battle ashore, and I could hand that problem over to Jeremy Moore, and I was very glad to see him arrive, and I instantly said, we're going to leave this place, going to move forward, because by then the three para were at Teal Inlet and four fire commando were at Douglas Station, and it was at that stage when we got a report from my brigade recce that an Argentine patrol, which turned out in the end to be a special force patrol, moved into a shepherd's hut called Top Marlow House, which was sort of in the middle of nowhere, below the main, between the two main sort of ridges which run across the Falkland Islands. And they were seen moving into this.
What strength were they?
They were about 11 strong.
That's big, isn't it?
Quite a big patrol.
Forces.
Yeah. Anyway, my recce troop commander was in touch with the chaps who were watching them. I said, well, okay, we've got to take these people out and get rid of them. So he got hold of his recce patrols that were in, as it were, and not committed to the ground, and put together a team of chaps. And the next day, a helicopter, as ordered, came and picked them up and dropped them off, and they then approached the position.
How close were they dropped?
Quite a long way away, a couple of miles, something like that.
So they made a concealed...
They made a concealed approach. Mm. They got to within quite close to the house without being seen. Mm. And then suddenly, it was a two-story house. A chap came to the window and obviously upstairs and saw them. So they banged a couple of 66s into the house. The chaps came running out. There was a brief firefight. And they killed a number of them, and the rest of them surrendered. Mm. And that completely sort of knocked the stuffing out of the Argentine OP network, because a number of the other OPs had seen, of their OPs, had wow. seen this action.
So they had a network of OPs forward.
They had some OPs forward mm. as well. They were starting to put a network out. They hadn't. Oh, yes. This was the beginning of it. And the others who saw what was happening lost heart and handed themselves over to Three Para, who by that time was sort of marching along to the south of Teal Inlet, and they came off, and so that totally destroyed the Argentine Special Forces patrol line, which meant that our patrols dominated now totally that ground, and we could operate with impunity along the route which led to the north of that high ground.
Yes.
And enabled us to bring, you know, fly headquarters. The Top Marlow House, that's Lower Marlow House there. Top Marlow House is there.
Yeah.
This doesn't show it very well, but the ground is, there's a big ridge line that runs along like that. Then there's a smaller one that runs along like that. So Top Marlow is sort of in the middle of these two ridge lines.
Mm. Had your forward screen noted or suspected that there were other Argentinian parties moving into the area?
No, they hadn't seen them.
They hadn't noticed them.
No.
So obviously they were reasonably...
Well, I think they were in the process of moving in that day when that action took place.
When they were caught out.
Yeah, when they were caught out. That was the sort of leading party. It was the CO of the company, OC of the company. And plus his people.
Mm. What happened to him? Was he captured
or
killed?
Captured. Oh, they were all captured or killed. Mm. Not one of them got away. Mm.
How strong was your force then that hit them in that...
Well,
in that location,
there were 16 men. Sorry, no, the patrol at Top Marlow House was 16. Now, the enemy was 16 strong, and he had about the same number. Huh. 12 men. 12 men assault group and a 4-man, 16 men. Mm. Exactly the same number, but surprise was the key
critical
to
factor,
key to them was a critical factor. Yeah. The total. The officer commanding was killed, trying to run off. Mm. 5 Argentines killed, 7 wounded, and the remainder 5 taken prisoner. Mm. Carter had 3 wounded.
A rather unequal result, isn't it?
Rather unequal result. Mm. It was a surprise and good field craft and so forth. One out on that particular occasion.
And also, I'd imagine the 66mm.
Well, yeah, they put two into the right into the house, which was a sort of wooden shepherd's hut.
Yes.
And they'd stacked it with all their ammunition and explosives. And the hut caught fire and then went up with a great roar. Mm. These chaps came bursting out and started getting into a firefight, but were just cut down by... Mm.
They were caught on the way, though.
They were caught on the way, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was a good effort, actually.
Mm. Yes, indeed. And presumably you got some more information from them once you'd...
We got some information from them once they'd been interrogated about what their special force plan was, which is why we knew there were others around.
What was that plan, then?
Well, their plan was actually, of course, enough to do what we were doing in reverse, which is sit on that high ground and look at our possible routes in. They didn't know which way we were coming. And they never knew which way, because they were taken out, they never really knew which way we were coming, right up to the end.
Mm. So you won the Battle of the Recce Screens?
We won the Battle of the Recce Screens, mm. Yeah. Mm.
Do you think that was a really critical advantage?
Oh, yeah, huge. Mm. Because for the next, and from that moment on, I mean, for the next 12 days, there were just continual helicopters shuttling along that route. All day long, mm. up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, and also Tiel Inlet became a major forward base with LSLs coming in there and unloading, and there's a lot of fuel and ammunition, was heavy stuff being dumped there, mm. and they might have raided it.
Quite.
And mm. secondly, they might have brought in air attacks down mm. on it as well.
I was going to say, what was the Argentine Air Force doing? One imagines they must have been flying recce.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Did they spot the Tiel Inlet build up?
They never did, as far as I know. I mean, I was terrified that they would. I mean, I wasn't. There were a number of indiscretions on the radio.
Ah.
I mean, I'm talking about the BBC.
Yes.
All of which emanated from Whitehall.
Yes.
And the one concerning Tiel Inlet was when we had not been there long, when we heard on the radio something to the effect that I sent a signal to the original headquarters where I said, I've just heard on the BBC World News reported that, quote, Tiel Inlet is HQ of force attacking Stanley, unquote. I'm absolutely fed up with hearing my plans broadcast on BBC News. This was emanated from MOD, believe it or not.
Would that be the MOD press office?
Could have been, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who it was. Mm-hmm. But it was again, another, like this Goose Green business, was mm-hmm. emanated from MOD. The two others I think I told you about.
Sailing from Ascension, you mentioned.
That's right, and the task force joining up mm. has ended. So that's four that I know of. God knows how many more there were. Mm. So, you know, it was pretty bad, I think. Mm. And it was about this time when we nearly had probably one of the biggest potential blue-on-blues in the whole war, when part of my recce troop were on a feature which overlooked Fitzroy, but was quite a long way from it.
Yes.
In that they could see what was going on, but they couldn't actually make out quite who it was. Mm. That's right, they were on a place called Smoko Mountain, yeah. The OP, and they reported an enemy Chinook landing at Fitzroy, because they didn't know that we had a Chinook, these wreckers, and we'd out in the field. They didn't realise that there was a Chinook on our side as well, no reason why they should. And I had a battery of guns in range, but which were sort of pointing that way, and they were picking the trails up and moving them round, when my BM said, I think we better check. We did a check with divisional headquarters, and it was two para. So we nearly lowered a fire mission battery onto the top of two para. We would have killed a whole lot of them. It would have been a disaster. By that time, two para had switched from my command.
When did you lose them?
I lost them when Fire Brigade arrived, because they were still down at Goose Green. Mm. Fire Brigade was sent down to Goose Green and took them under command. Mm.
When did that happen? Was that after divisional headquarters had arrived?
Oh, yes, it was after divisional headquarters arrived. Mm. It was after divisional headquarters arrived, and two para was still at Goose Green, so they came under command of Fire Brigade, who went into Goose Green.
Yeah.
As their headquarters. And Goose Green, as it were, were allocated the southern route.
Mm. Well, was there a clear boundary between territorial sectors for your brigade and Fire Brigade?
Yes, there was. Yeah.
So it was divided up in the conventional way then?
Divided up in the conventional way, yeah.
Who decided where that boundary line should run?
Divisional headquarters, yeah.
was that a reasonable decision?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was, in fact, two para came back to me before the next series of battles, but they stayed with 5 Brigade for about a week, I suppose, or a bit more.
But you still had three para.
I still had three para, yeah.
And you're mentioning difficulty about leaks and information and so forth. Were you aware of the presence of any journalists in the area at that stage?
Oh, we had journalists, yeah.
You did?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, they all, to use modern terminology, they were all embedded.
Mm.
But in fact, they were no problem. We never had any indiscretions except one, which I can talk about in a minute, from journalists. They became part of us, actually. And sort of on our side.
You domesticated them.
We domesticated them. Mm. And of course, we had it all going for us because there was no way, there was no sort of press centre where they could all go back and chat to each other and, you know, have a bath and you know, do their thing at all. And there was no hotel which they could all disappear to and rewrite their copies, drinking a cup, can of beer in comfort. There was nowhere for them to go except with us. Mm. They were either with us or totally back with the ships and out of touch. Mm. So we had total control of them.
Who did you have with you then in your brigade?
Oh, I had Max Hastings, Robert Fox, a whole stack of them.
Mm.
Patrick Bishop. Pretty well all the top ones who were out there were with us.
Mm. And what did you do with them? Did you keep them at brigade headquarters?
No. They stay with their units. They were just told
so
if you want to.
They're sent off to battalions.
That's right, and they just live with them.
Mm.
All the time, unless they came back to file a copy. Some of them were moved around a bit, but I mean, like Robert Fox and Max. But others just stayed with their people, just lived the life of a Marine or a parachute soldier, and just got on with it. And so you had them totally sort of under control.
Did you have arrangements for censorship? What they were sending out.
Absolutely.
How did that work?
Well, the only way they could send anything out was via Marisat.
Mm.
So you just had a chap saying, you want to send that on Marisat, let me have a look at it.
Mm. Was he your signal, sir?
No, I had a chap called Dave Nichols, who was a captain then, who was my press liaison guy, who was a chap who had been a company commander of the Dauphin and was a sort of Everest standard climber.
Yeah.
And was what I call a thoroughly good egg, a proper officer, who knew what it was all about.
Mm.
And so when the press asked him about things, he could give them the right answers or no answer at all. There were some MOD minders who were sent out who were completely useless.
What were these military or were they?
No, these were civilian minders. Most of them were sort of failed hacks.
Yes.
And they were regarded with contempt by the journalists.
Mm.
And actually were pretty ineffective, quite frankly.
Mm.
We found that I found dealing with the press jolly simple. I think all the chaps in my brigade found it. I think largely because the Marines and the Army had been used to the media in Northern Ireland. The dear old Navy, of course, found it terribly difficult and couldn't stand it and didn't quite know what to do with them.
How did the Marines and the paras treat the journalists then? Did they?
Oh, they just treated them as.
Take them in as.
As part of the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were just treated as. Quite a sort of friendly way, really.
Mm.
The only indiscretion that I know of was when one of the journalists, a chap called Jeremy Hands, who's now dead, is a nice chap, I liked him a lot, who was a television journalist for ITN, was in Teal Inlet, and he wanted to ring up his oppo, who was a journalist with 5 Brigade, who were in Fitzroy. And he knew that the telephone system was still working.
Oh, this is the landline.
The landline. So he placed a call to Fitzroy without realising the exchange was in Stanley, which was still in enemy hands. So effectively, the landline went into enemy country and then out again.
Mm.
Luckily, he wasn't all that indiscreet, but when I heard what he'd done, I gave him a real rip-off, actually. Mm. And that had sort of... That temporarily made us lose faith, I think, in the journalists. Mm. And I forbade any journalists to attend O groups or anything like that, which was a mistake. It was an overreaction. I mean, you know, we re-established relationships later, but it gave us a bit of a nasty turn to think that anybody... It was just stupidity, actually. It was not malice. He was just
not thinking.
Mm. And that led to a slight cooling off in relations for a bit. Robert Fox is quite interesting about it, actually, and if you ever had time, it might be worth interviewing. Now, the point is, you can actually cut deals with journalists if they're amenable to it, and it actually benefits both sides. I mean, some of them, you know, are too sort of proud or too stupid to want to do it. Mm. Probably the latter. But they get a lot out of it if they keep to their side of the bargain.
Mm. What would the terms of such a bargain be then?
Well, I can tell you the terms that Robert Fox will tell you that H. Jones terms of the bargain was that if you put my battalion into danger, I'll effing kill you.
That's not so much a bargain as a threat.
As a threat, but you know. No, I think the terms of the bargain is that you give them as much access as you possibly can, in return for which they will report, and you don't expect them necessarily to write you up in glowing terms, but they mustn't do or say anything which is going to endanger the lives of the people taking part. Mm.
What were they interested in? Were they interested in the strategy, the operational planning, the conduct of operations? Were they more interested in the realities of war, the human interest, an impression of what it was like to be there?
The latter. I mean, they were trying to paint a picture for the public, you know, the punters back home, of what the public back home, what was going on out there, really. I mean, the strategy and so on was only a sort of minor part of it, as far as they were concerned.
It was marginal.
And of course, they didn't get told what it was anyway.
Mm. How did they stand up to it physically, living in the field? And
some of them well, some of them badly, and some of them, you know, got frightfully cold, injuries, and had to be backloaded for their own safety. Some were okay. I mean, they were all what I call post-National Service era.
I should ask if any of them had actually done any military training, so they would know what they were seeing and how to involve themselves in the field.
Some. I mean, Max was probably the best, because he'd been a war correspondent for years and years and years, gone to Vietnam and Israel, you know, during the wars. This was but one of the many wars he'd covered. So he'd been a TA soldier, and as he admits, was a terribly bad soldier, and was completely useless at looking after himself in the field, he says. Mm. But he was, I suppose, the most at home, in the sense that he could tell whether it was worth hanging around or whether it wasn't. And when it wasn't worth hanging around, he hitched a lift back to a ship and got himself a warm bed and went to sleep, which was the best way to play it, really. Mm.
Who's responsible for their feeding and administration?
The feeding, the people they were with. So if you were attached to me as a journalist, I was responsible for giving you rations.
It was supernumerary then.
It was supernumerary. And they could either sort of go off into a little huddle on their own somewhere near the unit battalion position, or they could actually sort of share the position with a rear company and share a slip trench with someone who might look after them.
What were you doing about feeding when you were in the field?
Oh, what did I do? We had... I used to feed with my BV crew, which consisted of my driver operator, my orderly, and my, my batman, MOA, as we're Marine Officers Attendant, we call them the Royal Marines, well, orderly. And my, I had a bodyguard, an RMP sort of gunman, escort.
Close protection squad.
Close protection. It was just one chap called Dean.